So let's just start out here with some questions from our readers. The first one is from a woman named Liz Pascal Francis, and she has a question that says, I would like to hear how the book started in your mind. Did you work backwards from the disfigured women, or did it come together another way?
Well, that's a great question from Liz, and I think, honestly, for me, it all began with this image of a beautiful South Indian nun giving birth in a mission hospital in Africa. And I don't quite know where that came from, but that was something I had in my mind. And I also knew that I wanted to pour into this book everything I loved about medicine, particularly the study of medicine, the sense of, you know, a young person entering this field. And, you know, to me, it has always felt like a romantic and passionate pursuit. And I knew I wanted to populate the book with that strong sense of medicine, you know, its ups and downs. And I did not actually know the plot in any fashion. And I think I'm one of these writers who, you know, has an image and a tone and a voice and pushes it forward, and which has led to a lot of dead ends, a lot of retreating. That's very wasteful. But as soon as I did begin to see patterns, then, you know, I would go back and amplify them. So I hope that answers Liz's question. I don't quite know where everything is going. All I knew was I had a voice, and I had a great editor who would sometimes say, you know, there's just too many choices right now, and you have to make up your mind which direction you're going, and I would.
So you don't outline when you write?
You know, I think if I do another novel, which I will, and I will definitely, you know, do an outline, because as I said, I think if you don't have a scaffold, if you don't have a architecture, it's, you know, it's just such a such an inefficient process. And if you do have an outline, you know, I think I'm recognizing that you're not committing yourself to it. It's just a scaffold, and you're quite entitled to shape the building in a different way when you come to a different spot. So, you know, I'm seeing the merits very much so. But my instinct is not to outline and work backwards. My instinct is very much to begin with an image, a voice, a tone, and just carry that forward.
How long did it take you to write Cutting for Stone?
It took me 8 years off and on to write this book, not because it needed to take 8 years, but because my day job keeps me pretty busy. And, you know, with the kids, there was only so much time that I could get to the book. And I would occasionally string a day or two to a weekend and, you know, have some uninterrupted time, but not much. And, you know, I think that there were moments of despair where I didn't think this was going anywhere, and other moments where the pace picked up and I was excited. So, you know, I am dying to write another novel, if only to apply the lessons I learned on this one, which were considerable.
Where in the process of the 8 years of writing did you get an editor, an agent, decide that you wanted to publish it? How did that work?
Yeah, I think my experience with editors is really quite unique. I had the most wonderful editor, Robin Desser, who had worked with me on my very first book, My Own Country, a nonfiction memoir, and I admired her. And when I started writing this novel, most people finish a novel and then try to sell it, but I went to my agent after I had a couple of hundred pages, and I said, you know, Mary Evans is my agent, and I said, I would like some affirmation that this is worth pursuing. I'd like you to try and sell it, even though I know that's atypical. And she wasn't averse to it, so sure enough, she tried, and Knopf was very interested and bought it, which was a wonderful, you know, impetus for me to feel like I had something, a commitment. And, you know, obviously the first thing they asked was, okay, you've thrown all these balls up in the air, you know, a nun giving birth to twins, what's next? And I just made something up. I really didn't know what's next. And where Robin was so precious was, you know, first of all, her faith in me. Second, her forbearance as I went down these dead ends. And she had the most wonderful way of saying, Abraham, these 300 pages, 6 months' work is just gorgeous stuff, but it doesn't belong in this book. And, you know, and you have to have great faith in an editor to be able to take that. And frankly, you know, there's a point where you lose all perspective and you want someone who's objective to reinforce the parts that are good that you might not even recognize are good, and to take away those parts that you're very fond of, but, you know, are tiresome to the reader. So killing your darlings, as they say in writing, she was very good at helping me kill my darlings and, you know, recognize when the writing was bad and reinforce when it was good. And I honestly think that her faith that a story with so much of Ethiopia in it could, you know, be of compelling interest to a reader, carried the day. I mean, had she said to me, you know, this story should be much less about Ethiopia and all about the Bronx, I would have definitely just gone in that direction, if she said this is what the American reader wants. And so, you know, I have a great deal of faith in her, and I recognize that I've been incredibly lucky, really lucky to be with an editor with such a strong aesthetic and a successful one.
Yeah, definitely. And I know you mentioned your day job, and I wanted to sort of pose to you another question from one of our readers named Rebecca Boyle. She says that she would love to hear you address any similarities between writing a novel and performing surgery. I think both can be works of creation. Both can be completed on behalf of strangers, but still remain very personal experiences. Do you see any parallels between the two?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, first of all, I should, as a disclaimer, say I'm not a surgeon, an assumption that many people make. I'm actually an internist, an infectious disease specialist. And, you know, when I made the choice to go into internal medicine and not surgery, I did so because I love medicine, but I had loved surgery, and my mentors had assumed that I'd go into surgery. And I left surgery with some regret because I knew that I was turning my back on something that had a great deal of romance and excitement to it, but there was a repetitiveness to it, at least my perception, that led me away and into something like medicine, where I felt that I would be endlessly challenged and I would never know enough, and the horizon was continually expanding. But I should also say another caveat, and that is I don't really make a distinction between being a physician and being a writer. In other words, I think people are too ready to give me two hats, that I'm a physician and then I switch hats and become a writer. I mean,
It's more seamless for you.
Yeah, I am first and foremost a physician. I mean, that is completely how I identify myself, and I look out at the world through that stance of, you know, great privilege. I mean, I actually, you know, feel like tearing up when I say that, because it's, you know, it's such a privilege to me to have completed a medical education and then to be entrusted with the most intimate of stories and to be a witness and even a catalyst and a participant and hopefully helpful to people in the most, you know, difficult moments of their lives. To me, that remains just a great, great honor. And my writing, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, to me comes from that stance. And even if it's fiction, to me, it represents, you know, giving voice to the kinds of truths that medicine allows you to see. I'm a great believer in the quote that, you know, fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. The great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. And, you know, in writing a novel, I'm actually, you know, my colleagues probably would scoff at this, but my sense is that it's a form of credible research. I am, you know, I am trying to arrive at certain truths. And the fact that, you know, a book like this is doing so well is immensely comforting to me, in the sense that I feel like I'm conveying a certain truth that hopefully makes medicine more understandable, not from a factual point of view, but from sort of a emotional, instinctual point of view to the reader. So to come back to your reader's question, I think there are many parallels in the writing of a novel and my day-to-day sort of specialty. You know, when I see a patient, I take a history. And what is a history but a story? You know, and the older I get, the more I'm conscious that, you know, when I see a patient that the junior doctors have seen and I'm involved, if I'm able to add something to that patient or, you know, unearth the thing that helps solve the issue that they're wrestling with or the diagnostic issue, it's rarely because I bring some superior knowledge. You know, knowledge has become quite democratic. We carry it on cell phones and PDAs and so on. It's usually because I hear that story and I have a greater repository of stories that I can match that story with, or it echoes for me in a right brain sort of way with a vague story that I recall, and I look for the other missing elements. And, you know, then I go to the body and I'm looking again for the parts of the narrative that would fit this story that I have in mind and see if that fits or doesn't fit. Or I stumble onto something on the body that suggests, oh, this is another kind of story. So in that sense, I suppose physicians are all engaged in a kind of narrative, if you will.
Or you wish they were.
I'm sorry?
It would be good if they all were.
It would be good if they all were. But, you know, coming back to the old, I think it's Plato, or was it Aristotle's concept of story being about conflict, crisis, and resolution? I think it was Aristotle. You know, the arc of story is conflict, crisis, and resolution. And, you know, when a patient comes to you, in a sense, you know, there's a sense of crisis there. Even on the most routine visit, there's the sense of danger that, you know, this could be the visit where something is unearthed. And, you know, the resolution of the crisis is arriving at good news, or sometimes even in the midst of bad news, arriving at some insight that life can go on, or that life is ending. But you know what? It's ending for us all. None of us is spared. So in that sense, I think I'm completely engaged in story, whatever I'm doing, you know, whether it's writing or caring for patients.
Here's another question for you from reader Renee Smith. She says, I am almost done with the book. I love the struggle presented with the Yeats poem about choosing perfection of the life or of work. I have come to believe that we need both types of people in the world. How did you come to choose this poetic question as a theme for the book, and which choice do you see yourself as having made?
Yeah, I think the reader is referring to the Yeats poem, The Choice, which goes like this. The intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work, and if it chooses the latter, must forego a heavenly mansion raging in the dark. And, you know, I love that poem because I sense that medicine presents us with this false dichotomy, or rather this temptation that you come to medicine incomplete. You come to medicine because, in a way, you're wounded, and you enter the profession. And the grand privilege that medicine gives you is you care for others and your woundedness becomes healed. And we have many, many workaholics in medicine. I certainly remember a phase in my career when I was like that, where, you know, my sense was that if I just did this medicine thing very well, then I would be forgiven everything else. I didn't need to be, you know, a good husband or a father who was very present or an important part of my community. I just needed to do this thing well. And I think that there are many of us who are like that. And I think that the wisdom of that poem is that, you know, perfection of the work won't get you perfection of the life. You have to really think of these as two parallel trains. You know, there's a life and then there's a work, and they run on parallel tracks, and there are times when one gets a little ahead of another and another time when, you know, one lags behind. But you can't let them get too far away. I'm actually very convinced that human beings need to work to feel fulfilled. Mm. Human beings need to love and feel love, whether it's you know, filial love, parental love, you know, romantic love. These are sort of the essential ingredients, and maybe that is the name for the two trains. Instead of calling it life and work, one could call it love and work. And they can't get too far apart before you get into trouble.
I'll ask you one last question for today. This is from Susan Quinones Jennings, who says, who are your favorite authors, and do you ever find spare time to read? You sound like a very busy man.
Do I find time to read?
Yep. The last part? Yeah, between the medicine and the writing.
Well, thanks, Susan, for that question. I find that I'm reading a lot in the sense that I have books going all over the house, and I tend to be a somewhat impatient reader. If the writer doesn't hold me within a few pages, then the book is doomed for me, even though it might be a great book and by other reports is a great book. So because of the time pressure, I'm afraid I'm not the most patient of readers, even though I think some of the novels I like best, some of the old you know, English classic novels from Middlemarch on, don't have the kind of pace that I think readers now want. Mm. So I read widely. Some of my favorite authors are Gabriel Garcia Marquez, John Irving. You know, I love the ambition and scope of you know, both those writers' works. But you know, I read in the you know, sort of mystery detective genre a lot. I find that entertaining. Ian Rankin, a Scottish writer who, you know, I love his series set in Edinburgh. And I think perhaps what I love about those the most is the setting, the great sense of place. I love Jean Le Carré. I read poetry. But you're right, I don't have a great deal of time to read, but I do feel, and I preach to my medical students, that we need to keep the right brain stimulated, that there's something about this exercise of taking those little figures we call words on a page and taking them into our brain and making this mental movie, this fictional dream that spools out, that is so much a partnership, your creation as well as the creation of the writer. I mean, the writer can't do it alone. They need you to provide your imagination. Well, I feel that, that sort of exercise is so necessary to keep the brain from atrophying, and especially to keep your clinical imagination from atrophying. So I see it not as a luxury, but as I tell my medical students, I see it as an absolute necessity. And I hope I get through.